The Proms premiere of Krzysztof Penderecki's Concerto Grosso for three cellos and orchestra. Arthur Norris, Leonard Elshenbrock, and Daniel Mullershot, the three cellists. Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Charles Dutoit. Penderecki began composing that in 2000, commissioned for the NHK Symphony Orchestra in Japan. Charles Dutoit, music director there at the time. Jules Merck, Hannah Chang, and the late Boris Pergamentchikov were the soloists at the premiere. Here come tonight's players back onto the platform. Spanning the ages, Frankfurt-born Leonard Elshenbrock in his 20s. Studied in the UK at the Menuhin School, member of the Radio 3 New Generation Artist Scheme. He was playing second cello. Bow there for Lawrence Davis, principal horn in the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. Daniel Mullershot, he's in his 30s, born in Munich. Great Britain enthusiast, recently recorded the suites in the Cello Symphony. He was playing third cello. And the veteran Finnish musician Arto Noras, who studied with Paul Tortelier at the Paris Conservatoire in the 1960s, playing the first cello part. All three will play the work together again with the Boston Symphony Orchestra next year to celebrate Penderecki's 80th birthday. And as I say, that work included as part of this major Polish theme in this 2013 BBC Proms, inspired by the centenary of Lutosławski. Much more Polish music to come. Do check out the website for more details, bbc.co.uk/proms. The three soloists back together, arm in arm. Just standing behind the risers that painted Royal Albert Hall blue for them this afternoon. Paint now safely dry. Charles Dutoit standing at the back of the platform as the soloists now leave the stage. Well, that brings us to the interval of tonight's concert here on BBC Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms. Two French works in part two, Debussy's La Mer, and the second suite of music from Ravel's ballet Daphnis and Chloe. First, though, during the interval, a Proms Plus literary event held earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music. We join Samira Ahmed and guests as they celebrate the 20th anniversary of the death of Rudolf Nureyev, celebrating his life and legacy.
Tonight I'm talking to the former director of the Royal Ballet, Dame Monica Mason, and biographer and former ballet dancer Julie Kavanagh about Rudolf Nureyev, the Russian Kirov dancer who became ballet's first pop icon. In 1961, aged just 23, he became the first Soviet artist to defect to the West and was a superstar from the start. His dramatic style and his electrifying partnership with Margot Fonteyn at the Royal Ballet are legendary. Monica, you were at the Royal Ballet when Nureyev arrived in London in 1962, and you did the rehearsal room, I think, when he first walked in. What was he like?
Well, actually, I was on the outside of the rehearsal room, peeking through the door, a whole pile of us, because we'd heard there was a stranger in our midst, and that he was rather gorgeous. And so we all looked in the door, and of course, immediately one saw this extraordinarily beautiful person. And then in no time, he did a performance, and then he came and worked with us. And so I don't think I ever got used to his beauty, though. I always thought he was quite extraordinarily, unusually beautiful to look at. And well, I think you only have to look at the photographs of him today. In a way, the photographs so clearly illustrate this extraordinary person. I mean, such a commanding presence, an astonishing energy, and, you know, he had a sort of cunning, but he was charismatic, totally charismatic, but very generous in his work with us, and we loved having him around and we learned so much from him.
Julie, what was the English ballet scene like at the time that he arrived? You know, how far was he really shaking things up?
Well, I think at that time, male dancers were there really just to mostly support the ballerina. I mean, the famous Michael Soames was Margot Fonteyn's partner, and Bobby Helpman had been there. There were starting to be younger people, weren't there, Monica? Like Chris Gable, who had a sort of glamour. But I think the day Rudolph arrived, crashed onto the scene, he really raised the bar. I mean, he had a Soviet technique, which was something the English had never seen.
What did that mean?
Well, I think it was a bravura. It was obviously ability to do pyrotechnics. There were other things like the Kirov dancers moved in a very beautiful, lyrical, adagio way. So I think no male dancer had almost feminine arms in the way that Rudolph did. And I don't think any male dancer until him had been an object of desire. Perhaps Nijinsky was, you know, but before it would always been the ballerina who was and Rudolph came and all eyes were on him.
So he pushed himself the entire time and he expected you to do the same, and so you just did. I mean, you had to go that extra mile because he was, and he just provoked you into nearly killing yourself.
And what was it about his performance that really stands out for you?
It was his whole being. I think, you know, somebody who jumps ship the way he did at that airport in Paris.
This is when he defected.
When he defected, on the spur of the moment, really, and arrives with a few francs in his pocket and owns nothing, and then becomes one of the big pop stars of the world at that time. That takes guts. He didn't lack guts.
I think in the book, when you were researching his life, you said he was taught by a teacher very early at ballet school, someone who'd seen Anna Pavlova, that there was this art of using your personality to blind the audience
Indeed.
To flaws. Is that a good way of
Indeed.
Looking at his approach?
I think that's exactly what it was. I mean, I think when I wrote about Ashton's biography, he'd love to describe the way Pavlova would... It was the sort of impact of personality, and you wouldn't look at the fact she was slightly turned in or something. She would be such a vibrant, exciting personality. And I think that was Rudolph's secret. And I remember talking to Baryshnikov about that, and he said, you know, which was true, that Rudolph could be very hit and miss, you know, but he would use this blazing personality to blind an audience to the flaws.
Was it the same?
Yes, exactly the same. And I think it was, even when he was in the rehearsal studio and he was working with you, he manipulated you, really, in a way, in a wonderful way, so that you would do anything for him. And, of course, there were wonderful moments when you knew that Rudolph was gazing out into the audience, looking extraordinarily beautiful, mm-hmm. and that nobody was looking at you.
I want to talk a bit now about the kind of incredible narrative of Nureyev's life story. You know, Julie, he's born on a train in Mongolia. He has a childhood real poverty. And there's a snobbery about his kind of ethnic, kind of Tatar origins as well. And yet he knew from the age of five that he wanted to be this great ballet dancer.
Yes, I think he went to a theatre. His mother, they were incredibly poor, and his mother smuggled her children in. And, I mean, I think he said, and then the gods came dancing, and it was the most epiphanic moment for him. And he, after that, he just had this incredible drive and vision and set his heart on this was he was going to do. But his father, who was a Red Army soldier who was disgraced and came home, wanted his children to have an education their parents never had, and so wanted him to be an engineer or something, and was forever trying to prevent Nureyev dancing. And I think that really made him even more passionate and fired it up even more.
Is it something he talked about at all, Monica, when he was in London, about his background, about what he'd come from?
No, not that I was conscious of. What I was aware of, though, was his desire to travel, because in those days it was quite unusual for dancers to go to visit other companies. There were examples of it. Some of the leading ballerinas had been elsewhere. But as a general rule, people stayed with the companies they were with. And Rudolf seemed to feel that, you know, the world was his oyster. He was just going to go everywhere. And I think sometimes it seemed to me as if Rudolf saw the world like this enormous dining table full of all these wonderful dishes to taste from around the world, and that he would gobble up everything that he possibly could. And he went to America and he worked with choreographers that ballet dancers had never worked with before. He went into the contemporary dance scene and sort of devoured that as well. And it was the beginning, really, too, because it was, you know, the ballet scene in the 60s was still quite naive in a way. It was only later on in the 70s and 80s that one could see the possibility of cross-fertilization and that what contemporary dance could perhaps bring to the classical world and vice versa, and that one could think of dancers crossing from one side to the other, because we'd always stayed very much in our territory and it was very clearly marked out. And he was one of the first people, I think, to open up those possibilities.
I'm intrigued, Julie, as to how he was able to do that, because his artistic focus in many ways, that upbringing, was sort of looking back to the 19th century, wasn't it? And yet he breaks all these barriers about modern and classical dance.
Well, I did feel that it was one of his prime motives for defecting was to work with as many choreographers as he could, because the repertory in Russia was sort of dusty warhorse classics. And, I mean, he'd done that, and he was a star there. It's sort of forgotten that he was already a star when he came to England. But, I mean, yes, we take for granted now that the crossover between... But he was the one who broke the barriers.
But also, you know, this word greed, or this kind of this idea of the dining table of the world, Monica, as you put it so beautifully, this drive to learn about every aspect of his art. So very early on, he wants to learn to read scores. And, of course, that comes out later when he becomes a conductor.
Indeed.
I mean, is there anything we can understand about how he developed this? Was this just his personality?
I think it was his personality. I mean, I think he was always feeding the dance. And I think he would seek out people, even lovers, to feed his dance. I mean, he saw photographs of Eric Bruhn in Dancing Times that had somehow got to Leningrad, and he saw that that was the line he wanted for his own body. This was the look that he wanted to aspire to.
Danish,
the
Danish
style. This was Eric Bruhn, who was a big Danish star, who was also, I suppose, an international star as well. And he and Nureyev became lovers. I think Bruhn was probably the love of his life. But originally, he went to Bruhn to learn how to dance like Bruhn did himself.
That, to me, was one of the most extraordinary things. I never could understand that, and I still don't today.
Why?
Well, because Eric Bruhn, it was sort of as if you could imagine Wagner wishing he was Mozart. Because Eric Bruhn was this kind of, not ice cold, but this cool Danish personality, very shy, very reserved. And here was this sort of panther of a person.
But it was Dionysius and Apollo, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right, yes, yes. And it sort of, I found that astonishing, because although I thought Eric was such a fine, elegant dancer, to me he didn't command... He didn't have the commanding presence of Rudolf.
I was wondering about him sort of as a team player, or as a kind of a soloist. I mean, he wanted to work with kind of great choreographers like Balanchine, but Balanchine famously said he didn't want a star performer, you know. Don't get the sense Nureyev was a team player. Is that fair?
Well, yes and no, except that he did love being with the Royal Ballet. And I think because he so revered Ninette de Valois, who founded the company and who was the director at the time that he arrived, and she saw the opportunity to put Margot and Rudolf together in Giselle. She was so clever. And she allowed him to break all the rules, which a lot of older dancers found extremely difficult, because the things that everyone had thought mattered so much, suddenly Rudolf was not paying any attention to. But I think that his development was fast when he came to the West, but then after a while, he travelled so much and he danced so much, he completely exhausted himself. I mean, there were days later on in the 70s, I remember, when he was doing his seasons at the Colosseum and he'd been dancing solidly with the Dutch National Ballet, and previously he'd been in America on tour with us, when he actually couldn't speak and you would ask him a question and he hadn't got the energy to reply. I can remember looking at him and thinking that he was about to die at any minute. He looked so completely exhausted. And of course, you know, he relied so much on his masseur and his assistants around him to look after his food and his drinks, his cups of endless cups of tea with lots of sugar lumps in them, and how they even used to dress him and undress him because he hadn't got the energy. And they carried all his clothes round for him and his bag of shoes. And he was waited on hand and foot, which we accepted because we knew that he couldn't possibly bend down and pick up his own bag. He was so exhausted.
Does it matter in a way that he wasn't a team player? Because his personality was difficult, and he did fall out with important people in his life as a result, didn't he, Julie?
Yes, he did. I mean, I think he could never have been a Balanchine dancer, which is what he wanted more than anything, because I think the whole communist regime is sort of, you know, pushing down the individual, which is Balanchine's aesthetic as well, and no stars could shine out. And Rudolf couldn't do that. But I know that Frederick Ashton cast him in a ballet called Symphonic Variations, which is just a sextet of dancers, and Margot was in it as well. But he wanted, everybody had to be together. They had to be, it had to be a little entity. And Rudolf wasn't capable of doing that.
And yet, I mean, you worked with him on the Jerome Robbins Dances at a Gathering in 1970, and that was him very much part of a company and a great success, wasn't it?
I think he loved being part of the group there, and he actually was very fond of the young men in that group, and he liked being a part of that ballet. And, of course, the piece was new to us. It was new to everybody. But, you know, Jerome Robbins had to really put his foot down very firmly because there would be lots of moments when Rudolf was very keen on improvising or breaking the rules. And Jerome Robbins was someone who really attended to your little fingernail. And Rudolf, he respected Jerry so much, and he knew that he was in the presence of someone who really knew the business A to Z. But at the same time, that little devil inside him was always daring him just to push that little bit
harder. Did you see incidents where there was real trouble in the rehearsal room?
He just challenged. Rudolf challenged everything. But Jerry was ready for him. Rudolf had met his match, really.
I want to look beyond at legacy, because Nureyev, of course, died very, very young. He was only 54. You get a sense that he really did want to raise and change the status of the male dancer. Was he successful, do you think, Julie?
I think the way sort of dancers dance now is thanks to Rudolf. I mean, he did something with the purity and the beauty of the male line, I think dancers today have much flashier techniques, and they can do things that Nureyev couldn't have done. But, I think Monica would probably know more than I do, but I think just in terms of if you take a dancer like Polunin, I mean, he's there because of Nureyev in that link.
Yes, I think that Rudolf influenced David Wall especially, because David Wall was about 10 years younger than Rudolf. And I think David realised that there was another way to dance and perform. And Rudolf enabled the men to be more bold and brave. And what he did was to bring them alongside the ballerina, instead of always being that one step back. Because our tradition really with the classics and everything, at the end of a big pas de deux, the woman comes forward and the man presents her, and then he steps back one step. Rudolf never stepped back. He was right there alongside. This was even Stephen's time. And I think he... And we got used to it, and it felt right. And Rudolf made us... He taught us that lesson. And then there were instances, of course, after that, when somebody might have pushed you forward. But it then became natural for the man to stand alongside the woman.
Ballerinas who wanted to learn as much as he did, and I think when Bayadere, when you were one of his choices of ballerina, and I remember talking to Lynn Seymour as well. I mean, he chose a trio of ballerinas who really had the same hunger that he did, and he respected ballerinas. I mean, I think in a way he did as much for the ballerina as he did for male dancers.
Yes, he allowed you to think that you could perhaps use what were some of your strengths in a little more daring way. Because as a dancer, I loved jumping. And so Rudolf gave me a variation that had jumping. And then he said, but we're going to slow it down so that you can jump higher. And years later, when Natalia Makarova defected and she saw us dancing Bayadere, she said to me, do you realize that he's making you do that variation like a man? And I thought, I like it like that. Rudolf did that for me.
How interesting. Time for some more questions at this point, if anyone has one.
How was his language? Did he speak English well, or could he express himself in words?
He was fascinated by language, and he was very inquisitive about everything. And he would sometimes come up with a word and say, indefatigable, explain. And we would go, where's the dictionary? And then we would go away and look it up and come back the next day and tell him. And then he would keep using it, indefatigable. You know, that's just a for instance. But he was, he learned to swear in many languages. And of course, one of the things about Rudolf was that he could be astonishingly vulgar.
How do you mean vulgar?
Well, crude. I mean, he said dreadful things, and he called people terrible names, and he hated the fact that he very often couldn't provoke us to scream back at him. And he wanted so much to see a real display of temperament. And for a lot of us, that was just alien. I mean, there was no way I could scream back at him.
Did he try to provoke you?
Until one day I did. One day I screamed so loudly at him, and I rushed out of the rehearsal room and shut myself in the dressing room. And by, there was this little knock on the door round the wall. He said, I know you're in there. And with that, he slowly came in. And then he put his arms wide and he said, you know I love you, and I've waited for years for this.
That's a great story.
Julie Kavanagh and Dame Monica Mason, thank you both very much indeed.
That was Samira Ahmed with Proms Thus from the Royal College of Music. The producer was Natalie Steed. BBC Radio 3, home of the Proms. Petroc Trelawney with you at the Royal Albert Hall this Thursday night. The Royal Philharmonic Orchestra back on stage. Charles Dutoit conducting this evening. Ahead, music from Ravel's Ballet Daphnis and Chloe and Debussy's La Mer. First of all, a word from Dutoit. When we spoke earlier, I reminded him about the extraordinary longevity of his relationship with the RPO. A relationship that stretches back almost half a century.
Oh, you tell me, yes, indeed, yes. I made my debut in 1966 at the Festival Hall with the RPO, and Malkusinski was the soloist, imagine that, the pianist. So it would have been a couple of seasons, 50 years, yeah. Well, many, many concerts we have done, because at the beginning, you know, in the late 60s and 70s, I was working with the orchestra quite a lot. We were touring enormously in England. We played everywhere, you know.
The players have obviously changed quite a lot over those 5 decades, but there must be plenty of familiar faces when you come back to the orchestra.
When I first arrived here, I had a rehearsal with the orchestra, and everyone was smoking, you know, during the rehearsal. And I just couldn't believe it, you know. I've never seen that in my life, although I was still very young, you know. But it was very strange to see the concertmaster writing bowings with a cigarette and so on. It was really funny. Of course, it has changed a lot of young people, but still the core of the orchestra, I mean, I think there is only one person or two who played at that time. Otherwise, you know, all orchestras now are much younger and change, of course, a lot.
No smoking on stage or off stage at the Royal Albert Hall these days. Next, Charles Dutoit is going to conduct the orchestra in Debussy's ravishing seascape La Mer, his trio of ocean pictures, From Dawn to Midday on the Sea, Games of Waves and Dialogue of the Wind and Sea. As Gerard Lana writes in the programme tonight, despite the titles, it's generalised atmosphere that the composer is painting here rather than specific detail. His pieces are called symphonic sketches, and they are at least as symphonic as they are picturesque. That said, I think it's reasonable to imagine the opening movement starting in darkness and concluding under the bright noonday sun. And it's an approaching storm that marks the start of the finale. Charles Dutoit working his way through the tightly packed players of the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra to conduct them now in Debussy's La Mer.
Thank you.
The dialogue of the wind and the sea, the last of the three symphonic sketches that make up Debussy's La Mer. Charles Dutoit conducting the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. Games of Waves, the central movement, from dawn to midday on the sea, the first. Debussy finished La Mer at the Grand Hotel in Eastbourne, worked there July and August 1905 in room 200, a suite. He was in the popular Victorian summer resort with Emma Bardak, married to a well-to-do banker at the time, very pregnant with Debussy's only child. I think that room 200 is now known as the Debussy Suite. Grand Hotel was also the home of a weekly live broadcast on the BBC called Grand Hotel every Sunday night from 1924 to 1939. Quite sure it featured Debussy, however. Charles Dutoit leaves the platform. Royal Philharmonic Orchestra on its feet. Well, we started tonight with Stravinsky's Fireworks, one of the pieces that opened Diaghilev's ears to the possibility of commissioning Stravinsky to write for the Ballet Russe. When they met, Ravel was already on the impresario's watch list. In 1909, Diaghilev decided to introduce Ravel to his chief choreographer, Mikhail Fokine, and see what the two men came up with. The result was a ballet based on the story of the love affair that develops between the goatherd Daphnis and the shepherdess Chloe, as told by the 2nd century Greek writer Longus. An hour in length, Daphnis and Chloe was the longest piece of orchestral music Ravel ever wrote. The journey from the start of the project to its conclusion was not entirely smooth. There were some creative tensions with Fokine. Things didn't go well when the work was played through by orchestra. Ravel temporarily lost interest. But then came the triumphant premiere of Stravinsky's Petrushka in 1911, and Ravel realized that similar international fame could be his if only he could get this commission right. When the work was premiered in June 1912, Karsavina and Jedinsky danced, and it was a huge success. Well, in the centuries since, though still a ballet staple, the score has become an even more familiar work in concert halls. Ravel helped by producing two suites of about 15 minutes each, and it's the second that we're going to hear this evening. Based on the ballet's finale, features three scenes: a sunrise culminating in the lovers' reunion after an enforced separation, symbolic pantomime involving the wooing of Syrinx by Pan and a declaration of undying love between Daphnis and Chloe, followed by a great old party. Charles Dutoit returns to the platform for the last time to conduct the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra in Ravel's second suite from his ballet Daphnis and Chloe. the second suite from Ravel's ballet Daphnis and Chloe. Charles Dutoit conducting the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra here at the Proms. My aim, wrote Ravel, to compose a vast musical fresco. I've been not so careful about archaic details as loyal to my visionary Greece, which is closely related to Greece imagined and depicted by the French painters at the end of the 18th century. Joaquin, the choreographer, however, wanted something more authentic, something closer to those Greek scenes depicted on the sides of ancient Greek vases, which may explain part of their creative disagreements in the years that it took to put Daphnis and Chloe together. Triumph when it finally reached the stage. Charles Dutoit centre stage now here at the Royal Albert Hall with the players of the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, with whom he has worked with for very nearly half a century. 1966, when he first conducted this ensemble. He goes for long relationships for 25 years, artistic director of the Montreal Symphony Orchestra, recently celebrated a 30-year collaboration with the Philadelphia Orchestra, of which he's now conductor laureate. He's also enjoyed a long-term relationship with the NHK Symphony Orchestra in Tokyo. Back center stage now, shaking hands with the leader of the orchestra, Duncan Riddell. Well, after the lovers of Ravel's ballet, Daphnis and Chloe, we have more lovers for you tomorrow night in Michael Tippett's opera, The Midsummer Marriage. That starts at 6:30 here on BBC Radio 3. But for now, with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra on its feet, time to bid you once again a very good night from the Royal Albert Hall. And as Charles Dutoit returns once again to the stage, back to James Jolly at Broadcasting House.
Thanks, Petroc. That was Petroc Trelawney at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's prom on Monday afternoon at 2:00 here on BBC Radio 3. And don't forget that every prom is available for 7 days via the Radio 3 website. Now, if you enjoyed the Penderecki in the first half of today's prom, you might like to know that there's a Polish-themed collection of music from the proms performed so far this season. Just follow the links to Polish music at bbc.co.uk/proms.
It hasn't been heard at the proms in more than 35 years. Sir Michael Tippett's opera, The Midsummer Marriage, his answer to Mozart's The Magic Flute. The tale of two couples tested by a series of supernatural interventions on the shortest night of the year. Conducted by one of today's leading exponents of Tippett's music, Sir Andrew Davis, The Midsummer Marriage. Tomorrow at 6:30 on BBC Radio 3.
Now, we've a little time before our feature about Queen's University Belfast at 9:45. So until then, I thought we'd stay with the ballet and dip into the suite that Duke Ellington and Billy Strayhorn made from Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker Street. Thank you. Three numbers from the Nutcracker Suite made by Duke Ellington and Billy Strayhorn after Tchaikovsky. Stephen Richman directed the Harmony Ensemble of New York and guests.
The Edinburgh Festival's 2013. On radio, on TV and online throughout August on the BBC. And on BBC Radio 3, daily Queen's Hall recitals from the Edinburgh International Festival itself.
One of Edinburgh's loveliest music venues.
3 weeks of amazing music making for mid-morning festival goers.
Coffee, a croissant and a concert the order of the day.
Music from Edinburgh favourites and from stars of the future. Weekday mornings with Jamie McDougall, Marianne Kennedy and, to start the season, Donald MacLeod.
Greek string quartet, as I imagine, you've never heard it before. I know I never have.
The Edinburgh International Festival on BBC Radio 3. Weekday mornings at 11 o'clock.
And now our feature, first broadcast last November. Queen's University was for a long time the only higher education academic institution in Northern Ireland, located in the heart of Belfast and instantly recognisable by its red brick Gothic structure. Like so many colleges, it has had to adapt to change, but for Queen's, given its location, the changes were unique. Now on BBC Radio 3, William Crawley charts that journey in Queen's University, Belfast Built.
I'm standing in the quad of Queen's University Belfast, just behind the magnificent Tudor Gothic main building that's named after the architect, Sir Charles Lanyon, who designed it in 1849. This is the cultural heart of Northern Ireland's oldest university, a crossroads of student life, a focal point of one of the most important institutions of life on this island. The university is also home to the Belfast Festival at Queen's, which has just celebrated its 50th anniversary. But this university is flourishing today against the odds. It's faced greater challenges to its existence than any other college in Britain and Ireland. The three decades of conflict we still call the Troubles. What's astonishing is that academic and cultural life went on here throughout the worst days of that conflict. In this programme, I'll try to chart that remarkable episode in the history of Queen's. It's a story of institutional survival, but it's my story too, as a former student here.
There was a sense of musicality and poetry around. It's curious, maybe I'm romanticising it.
And I remember having arguments with the police on the steps of the Students' Union, trying to stop them coming and doing a raid and just saying, you know, we'll try and get these people out for you, but for God's sake, don't come. We had all sorts. It was an amazing time.
But we were talking about real live literature, as it were, and being part of its coming into being.
We went up into where Beveridge was supposed to be, and we discovered that he had been locked in his cupboard. And so we pulled him out, eventually got the room cleared, handed him back his university. Sort of thing you expect on a normal Tuesday afternoon in Queen's.
To understand the sometimes turbulent recent history of Queen's, we need to grasp how truly revolutionary the 1944 Education Act was. It gave every school-aged child the right to a secondary education, and post-war generations of students owe that educational right to the radical vision of a Conservative politician, Rab Butler. Within a few years, the Butler Act was to open the doors of universities like Queen's to a new kind of student. They weren't from privileged backgrounds, and they would ultimately reinvent the idea of the university itself. Paul Muldoon was one of that new generation. He's now a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet and professor at Princeton University. But he first stood in this quad in 1969 as a newly matriculated student of Queen's.
Big year for me and a big year for this part of the world, I think. And I remember vividly meeting my advisor of studies, and he asked me what I thought I might be doing at Queen's. And I told him I wasn't entirely sure. In fact, it comes a little bit of surprise that I got into Queen's. But I said, I think I might do some English. I'm sure I'll do English. He says, OK. Then what else would you do? And I said, I think that would probably be Celtic. And he said, and you know, you need a third subject in your first year. And I could see him putting two and two together. And he said to me, you know what a great subject is? I said, what's that? He said, scholastic philosophy. That's a great subject.
He thought you were going to be a priest.
I'm not sure what he thought I was going to be, but I could see the word papist written all over myself.
Sir George Bain, a former vice-chancellor of Queen's, was born and raised in Winnipeg, a Canadian city with a roughly similar population to Belfast.
I always felt strongly that people who didn't want to go across the water to study, it shouldn't be a second choice. It should be a first choice, and it should offer an education that was just as good as if he were going across the water to a red brick university in Great Britain.
Queen's may have been Northern Ireland's university on the doorstep, but as politics professor Paul Bew explains, its historical origins presented particular problems for the province's Catholic population.
To be very blunt about this, historically Queen's a Presbyterian university. Now, it wasn't a problem when Ireland had three other universities which were intended to be predominantly Catholic universities. Those other universities have not been forced to go through the same emotional difficulties in the 20th century that Queen's has had to go through.
Notwithstanding those inherent religious tensions, the journalist Alf McCreary, who was a student here in the early 1960s, remembers Queen's as a place where Catholics and Protestants were brought together, sometimes for the first time in their lives.
And gradually, because it was a small place, we mixed with each other, so we were de facto crossing the divide which we couldn't have crossed from our schools back home. And we weren't conscious of doing, at least I wasn't conscious of meeting with Catholics. There were other guys and girls I knew, nice people.
On the other side of Northern Ireland's political and religious divide, the future civil rights activist Eamon McCann also found worlds coming together.
And I didn't have that sort of relationship with anybody from a Protestant background in Derry. And indeed, such was the segregation of life in Derry, that would have been fairly difficult. One of my memories is that for myself and all my mates who came from St. Columb's in Derry, most of whom were from out of the bog side of the Craigan, working-class Catholic areas, I mean, we had Queens, you know, with the skip and the lilt in our step. We were pretty pleased to be there, and we were of a generation which didn't regard anybody as our betters, really. So we would have just been defiant about, you know, sort of the class nature of the place.
But it wasn't just Catholics and Protestants who were meeting and beginning friendships in the academic safety of Queen's. The poet Paul Muldoon.
And that was an era in which I was lucky enough, as all students were, to be able to have relations with our professors, with our teachers, i.e. teachers and students went drinking together, they went to parties together, and probably did one or two other things together. The upside of it, though, was that, you know, we did get to discuss literature and life with quite a wide circle of people, not only students, but some adults as well. I had to do my
thesis. One of Paul Muldoon's near contemporaries at Queen's was to become one of Britain's best-known broadcasters. Nick Ross studied psychology here in the late 60s and cut his journalistic teeth as a reporter for the student newspaper, The Gown.
The Gown?
Wow.
Wanted to see? This is Liz Pyle here, it's 1966 to 69. And then right.
1967.
So this is your...
This is my time when... I always think of my time at Queen's, or used to think of it anyway, as a sort of fulcrum of my life, pre-Queen's and post-Queen's. It had such a hugely important role in my life. It changed my life so completely. What else have we got here? This is me. Oh, dear. Here I make my first appearance in the House Committee will meet on Tuesday to decide whether or not contraceptive vending machines are to be set up. I propose there should be contraceptive vending machine. And that caused sort of a bit of outrage in the university. But what caused outrage throughout Northern Ireland is... hadn't occurred to me, actually. I ordered two, one for the women's lavatories as well. That was what caused outrage. The idea that women had sex as well as men was simply beyond the pale.
And, I mean, it was a very different era. I mean, never mind what was happening in the Northern Irish context. Northern Ireland in the world context was a very different place. For example, the 60s were just about arriving in Northern Ireland. in 1969, i.e., you know, the impact of the Summer of Love was really somewhat to the fore. So there were a lot of hippie types around. There was a lot of long hair. There were a lot of tie-dyes. So there was that kind of counterculture, let it all hang out, kind of hippie-dom.
With a much free love.
I honestly couldn't tell you. There was very little of it coming in my direction, that's for sure.
The French government has surrendered dramatically to the students of Paris and to the left-wing organisations.
This was, of course, in the context of student politics across Europe and street protests across Europe.
The Grosvenor Square demonstration in London in 1968 against the Vietnam War. You had riots in Paris. It was Czechoslovakia, it was the Prague Spring. You had the huge civil rights campaigns going on in the southern states of the United States. It's hardly surprising that people who are on the left of politics here didn't see this as nationalist, Republican on the one hand, unionist on the other. They saw it in a much more international context.
Within a few months, violence across Northern Ireland was spiralling out of control. Soon the British government would send in troops to restore peace, and power would be removed from the local administration at Stormont, and Westminster would assume responsibility for the government of Northern Ireland. As the world's press descended on this tiny province to report on a conflict that was gathering a deadly pace, a young law graduate from Scotland was about to take up his first academic position as a lecturer here.
I remember the physical impression that Belfast made on me as one came up Belfast Loch, and there was the mountain with the veil of rain. Very, very beautiful. I like the light in Belfast, get wonderful light effects. And I established myself at Queen's. And there then followed the most remarkable year, a wonderful year for me.
The former law professor Alexander McCall Smith is now better known as an internationally best-selling novelist, the creator of the number one ladies' detective agency series. But while he taught at Queen's, he was finding literary inspiration from some local writers connected with Belfast.
I was very affected by that marvellous novel, The Lonely Passion of Judith Hearne, which was recommended by a colleague who said, oh, have you read this book? And I was very impressed with Brian Moore, and I think I was struck by the way in which he, in that book, managed to get into the shoes of this Belfast spinster, really. And I think it was a very important influence for me.
Alexander McCall Smith wasn't alone in beginning to encounter other writers while at Queen's. Paul Muldoon became a student here in 1969, and his class tutor was the future Nobel Prize-winning poet Seamus Heaney, who was one of the first to recognise Muldoon's rare gifts as a writer.
To have an introduction to that milieu with a weekly meeting.
He found himself invited into the Belfast Group, as it became known, an informal weekly poetry workshop that met for nearly a decade and which is credited by some as the cradle of an extraordinary poetic flourishing that took place in Northern Ireland during the Troubles.
For a while in Seamus Heaney's house, for a while then when Seamus went off for a while to the States, in a pub that was then called the Four in Hand. You know, we were not sitting around as we were in a seminar. We were talking about real live literature, as it were, and being part of its coming into being. And that was pretty exciting. I think we even knew at the time that it was exciting.
And then the beginning of the violence starts. When is this? There we go, October 1968.
We do intend marching, sir.
Yes, well, yes. In touch with the
as long as we're not we're doing any harm.
We do
intend.
Let them come down. We are the people of Derry, and we intend marching in our city.
That's really quite interesting, isn't it? This is the beginning of the Troubles being reported on the front page of the Gown, following clashes between police and demonstrators during last Saturday's civil rights march in Londonderry.
5th of October 1968 is really the first spark that lit the fire and changed everything. And what happened after that was student politics was taken over, well, not by Republicans at all. It was by Marxist revolutionaries.
I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over